Here we are with my congressman, 1st District of Massachusetts, Richie Neal. And Richie, good to be with you again, as always. And I know how hard you're working, and I so appreciate it. Let me start by asking you about the one thing that you know more about than I think anybody else, and that's Social Security. Is it in danger?
No, it's not. And I think that if anything, it's a good time for us to be debating the future of expanding Social Security benefits to the American people. The average Social Security benefit now, average, is just a little bit outside of $16,000 a year. That's a little bit more than $300 a week. So people who, on average, receive Social Security are not getting rich off of the benefit.
No.
So I think that it's now a good time to have this discussion. If it doesn't happen, that doesn't mean we can't start the discussion now to talk about it. But there is no imminent danger to Social Security. And this idea that Social Security is threatened really doesn't stand up under the magnifying glass when you analyze it. When you look at retirement in America, people are going to hopefully have a form of either a 401k or a defined benefit and some personal savings, but always the bedrock guarantee of Social Security. I mean, you can outlive an annuity, but you cannot outlive Social Security. So I've been a champion of Social Security throughout my entire career. I led the charge in the House at the request of then Speaker Pelosi as well when President Bush proposed privatizing Social Security. And just think what would have happened if the Social Security Trust Fund had been turned over to Wall Street at that particular time. It would have been a disaster for the American people. So I am a guardian of Social Security. I meet regularly with the committee to preserve and protect Social Security. And I think that John Larson from Connecticut has really done a nice job of outlining a plan that he has that might even expand Social Security benefits.
Brexit. I love your work on Ireland and understanding what's going on across the pond. Is there a way out of that for them, or is it just, and is it going to end up in chaos?
Well, I think that right now the clock is ticking, and I must say that Boris Johnson and the Conservative government, they got themselves into this.
Yes, they did.
And they've had 3 years to manage the separation, which now is a pending divorce at the end of this month. And the big issue has been repeatedly that the European Union, coupled with their working group, the European Commission, they have said repeatedly that any plan for Brexit would have to leave the border open between the North and the Republic. And in fact, they've said the Good Friday Agreement is a model for how other governments across the globe might settle some of their differences. So I'm watching and reading it every day. I met with all of the parties back in April with the Speaker, and she supports our position as well, that there cannot be a trade agreement with the United Kingdom, a bilateral trade agreement, if there's any threat or harm that is done to the Good Friday Agreement.
So what do they do? If they do nothing, then what happens?
Well, I think it's going to be chaotic, and I think if they crash out of Brexit, which the Prime Minister has threatened to do, I think that you're going to see markets slump. You're going to see a problem with food deliveries. You're going to see a problem with currency exchange. And I also think that it's going to create chaos across the European Union. You need a settled procedure for leaving European Union, and that has been made clear now repeatedly. You have former Conservative Prime Ministers like John Major, as well as Labour Prime Ministers like Tony Blair and others, and they have repeatedly criticized the way that this has been handled by the Conservative government now. And I think a crash out of Brexit would cause a strong element of chaos across Western Europe, which eventually would make its way across the ocean as well as to Eastern Europe and Asia.
On a more domestic question, Kennedy or Markey?
Well, they're both very good friends of mine, and I've treated it that way and handled it that way. And I mean not friendship the way some describe it in Washington. These two are really good friends of mine. And I have been friendly with them socially and politically. I go way back with the Kennedy family, and Eddie Markey's a good friend of mine as well. So they've both sought my counsel, and that's the way I intend to proceed.
Are they going to be mad at you, one of them?
I've talked to the two of them, and I don't think that there's going to be any anger. I think that they both understand the realities of what's in front of us. So I don't get the impression, based upon, again, a long, long friendship, more than 35 years in the case of Ed Markey and with Joe Kennedy. I mean, I was a delegate for Teddy when he ran for president. I've been a friend of theirs forever. And as much as all of us wish this might not be happening, it's happening. So I think that maintaining that friendship is going to be paramount for me.
my political science background has to say, in the Taft-Hartley law, the people who were on either side didn't seem to do that badly, but the people who were in the middle got into a lot of trouble.
Well, I mean, that's one of the challenges, because obviously when you have personal relationships that sometimes are tested by professional relationships, there can be some room, I think, for disagreement. That's for sure.
Let's talk Syria for a moment. What do you think?
I think that the president created the chaos there. I think that the Kurds have been our allies in fighting back against ISIS. They were unyielding in their support of the American position. And I think for the president to do what he did, to announce we were leaving on a moment's notice, not prompted by any change in strategy, and then just 2 days later threaten the Turks with sanctions based upon the policy that he set in place.
I think it
sends the wrong signal to our allies across the globe, everywhere. I think that this notion that you can once again undertake a significant foreign policy measure without any input from state, without any input from the Defense Department, and just apparently taking a call from the Turkish Prime Minister, Erdogan, and then subsequently saying, well, we're going to let them do what they want in northern Syria. And I think it's a huge mistake. You can see now the Kurds and the Syrian Kurds are now making an agreement with Bashar al-Assad.
Is it your sense, as a great politician, is it your sense that there could be a pulling of the rug from out from under, you know, the president where the Senate Republicans are concerned?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think that they've been pretty vocal in their criticisms of how this has been handled. But the problem is there's no consistency to their opposition. It's one day they take the position of outrage, and then they fall back into, I think, the trap of being consistent Trump supporters without saying, look, I'm willing to walk out there and say that no matter what this means for my career, you are simply wrong on what you're doing, and you ought to change right now.
Can you hold the House?
Well, I think we definitely will hold the House, yes. I think the Senate is much more iffy, but I do think for sure we're going to hold the House, and I feel very good about the Republican retirements that are taking place. And I also think that I take great credit and satisfaction for the 42 seats that we won. I helped all of those candidates with fundraising. I helped those candidates coaching them about how to talk about major issues of the day. Mm-hmm. And I helped recruit them.
So I guess the question now is whether or not Donald Trump can be president again. What's your intuition?
Well, the concern I have, and I would express it again, it's the Electoral College. I mean, we are back to the same four states 4 years later, or 3.5 years later. And I think that we need to be mindful of that, but it's still Florida, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania that are going to test us. And I think that, again, we want to make sure that on some of these issues that we prepare not only to defeat the president, but just as importantly, to have a message that can maintain the Democratic majority that we've won in the House of Representatives. And clearly and keenly, Speaker Pelosi understands that.
I want to go back for a moment to your relationship with Elizabeth Warren, who is a good friend of yours and a progressive, obviously. Can she win, or will she have trouble getting back to the center?
Well, I think that that's going to be tested, and she knows that because we've spoken about that. And I think that she's taken these positions. They're definitive. They're clear. She has a series of plans, and I think that that has helped her immeasurably during the campaign season. There's this old argument that Mario Cuomo used about governing in prose and campaigning in poetry. That always stands out in my mind, and I think that the candidates, because there's so many of them, they've had to seek some opportunity for clarification of positions that they've outlined. But I think that for the moment, Senator Warren is doing fine by sticking to her guns.
Don't you think it's time for the hanger-oners to quit? I mean, after all, aren't they just muddying their waters?
Well, I think that one of the things that has not changed much in this campaign cycle, despite what we're hearing, that is that the top three are the top three, and you move to a bit of a second tier, and then you move to those who are on the fringes, perhaps trying to put themselves in positions to run for other offices. But by and large, the polling has pretty much held. I mean, there hasn't been that much of a change. There's a bump from time to time, as you know, but the bump then kind of settles back. And I think that that's why it's always important when you look at a poll to understand that fluidity in the poll means that despite what you have at the moment, it's still pretty difficult to change down the road. I mean, when we look back at the election between Trump and Clinton, many people will say, well, the polls were wrong. Well, actually, the polls were right.
Yeah, they were.
They were. I mean, the poll said she was going to win the popular vote, and she did by 3 million. What was missed was that the statistical error in those places that I noted a few minutes ago probably helped put him over the top based on turnout.
So last question. Was Joe Biden incorrect in not voicing advice to his son to get out from under these positions that he's holding?
You know, I think that that's a very perceptive question. I'll tell you why. I mean, John Kerry was defending his war record when he ran for president, which was just nonsense. Barack Obama was not born in Kenya, but they had to talk about it. They tried very hard not to. And Hillary Clinton did not have a debilitating disease that was going to keep her from the White House. And the playbook on the other side is all you need to do is keep saying it until the mainstream picks up on it, and then you create the echo chamber in conservative media, and that boosts outrage. And I think that in this instance here, that I think Vice President Biden is going to have to really do a reset. He's going to really have to be aggressive in that debate, the next debate.
Great to talk to Congressman Richie Neal, my congressman from the 1st District. Richie, great to see you around and about in Great Barrington, and it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks very much.